Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 3rd, 2019, and welcome to episode 187 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and not football. So, I'm Paul Hegstrom in Boston, and I am joined by two today. First in Sweden, Jack Nutting, how are you?
Hello, Paul. I'm doing pretty well.
And again, in Stockholm, not just Sweden.
That's true, specifically
I'm not just
Stockholm.
Paul in the U.S.
I am Jack in the Eastern Hemisphere.
Sorry. Wow, way to grab some land there, dude.
Nice. I guess we are in different countries. That's kind of cool. Truly international.
Mm.
And
I'm in different countries.
Yes. So also joining us is Carrington Vanston in Canada.
Yeah, exactly. Although I am also Carrington Vanston when I'm in Stockholm, Sweden. So
that's true.
Just saying. Canada, USA.
They wish.
All right. Off to a good start here. So this is
now let's talk about eBay.
Yes, I'm sure there were many things left hanging last time. So we're not going to talk about the big game because none of us know a thing about it. but apparently it's about to happen as we're recording. So, oh, actually, I think a local team of mine is involved.
Yes, Paul. Even I know that.
That's cool.
Haven't you lived in Boston a long time? Shouldn't you be Boston proud?
Yeah, you'd think. I think it's just not football proud.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, so Carrington had an idea that I think we...
Oh, blaming me.
Yes, I will blame...
My first idea was we recap, for another few hours, we recap eBay. That got shot down.
summarizing...
The idea was we wouldn't have any new info. We would just like go over the last info to make sure everyone heard it and stretch it out this time to take even longer.
Well, yeah, we rushed through some things and some of that's very important.
It could just be like a review of the previous episode. On our last episode.
That'd be great. Every episode could start with that. We'll just like cut to a complete copy of the previous episode to make sure people really got it. And we simply do that for every episode going forward, recursively getting bigger and bigger until we reach peak in televisionaries.
That's perfect.
Nice.
And then we can have an accompanying podcast with Chris Hardwick.
Excellent.
Okay. Anyway, so as I was saying, the host's topic today, actually a Carrington topic, which is he suggested the oldest software you're still using. I'm saying he, like I'm not just talking to you. So what programs do you still find use for today that originated back in the hazy past? And why are you doing this to yourself? What do you still use and is there a reason or is it just some sort of inertia?
For me personally, it's inertia and it's mostly business products. Things made a land grab in the 80s. And once your files are in their format, it's hard to jump out of that because everybody's using the files in those format. I do a lot of graphic stuff, and I had thought, I'm looking up some records here, like one of the oldest pieces of software I use is the Adobe stuff, like Adobe Photoshop, Adobe Illustrator. And I have been using those continuously for personal stuff and for business both of them since the 80s. Well, actually, Photoshop technically came out in 1990. But Illustrator, I thought, like, I miss the Aldus stuff. I will still make jokes about how I miss Aldus freehand. Like, I was full-on an Aldus guy, and I begrudgingly switched over to Illustrator. But looking at my notes and software purchase things, and weirdly, I have a record of, like, the software I've bought, I purchased Illustrator before freehand. So it looks like Illustrator, like the first version of that was 1987. I got it in the summer of 1987. And freehand, I didn't get till 1989. Now, obviously, I'm using newer versions of them, but it's been the same continuous piece of software with a recognizably similar interface for 30 years now. Like, it's crazy that I've been using Illustrator first begrudgingly, and now I just kind of have accepted my fate since June of 1987. That's crazy.
Wow.
Like, one piece of software that's right now in the dock of my computer that I've been using for 31 years. For a while, I tried to branch away to a different piece of software and use it concurrently, and then got dragged back into the Adobe hegemony. BB Edit is another one sitting in my dock. I use every day. It's open at the moment. I use it to take notes. And it looks like I got that in the summer of 1992. So that's July 1992, BB Edit 1. And I have been using that continuously now for 26 years.
Cool.
Yep. Those are unfortunately not the oldest pieces of software in my dock.
Oh.
Absolutely, unfortunately, a piece of software I have been using and disliking for 32 years straight, hated it from day one, Microsoft Excel.
Yay.
Yeah. You missed VisiCalc.
I still can't believe I'm using that stupid thing. Again, and that's, again, it's software that gets forced on me. I don't want to use Excel. I don't even want to have Excel. I don't pay for Excel. Work pays for Excel and forces me to have it on my computer. So I don't use it so much as, you know, I take it. It's like,
endure
so,
it.
I mean, but that's an example of software. Like, those are some things that I have now been using for basically all of them, you know, in rough numbers, 25 to 30 years, like 2.5 to 3 decades of continuous use of the same software, all still used daily driver software sitting in my dock. So something's changed and new things come around all the time, but it's crazy to me that I can be using the same, essentially the same software for that long with what seems to be relatively minor tweaks. I mean, if you look at Illustrator now and Illustrator then, it's gotten darker, it's gotten uglier, it's gotten, like, you know, 3,000 extra features, most of which I wish weren't there. If I could, I'd install Illustrator 88 today if it would just work with modern files. It just keeps adding complexity because they want to get you on an annual subscription, and they justify it by throwing in more toolbars, more and more toolbars. So I think those are the oldest bits of software I use. I mean, I use lots of older things as well, like that aren't that old. Things that have stuck around that are in my dock, like iTunes, I see down there. That's super old. Macintosh Calculator, would that count? That's crazy old. And that's the thing I use.
That. I think that demoed in 1984.
Yeah, and I still have that right now in my dock is Calculator because it's just convenient to use. So there you go. That's my oldest stuff, I think. What about you guys? Any of you guys raw? The software that I love the most, things like development environments, Xcode. Xcode's not that old. My email software has cycled through. My web browsers have cycled through. Like, the stuff I use and enjoy has all changed and is all different today fundamentally than it was, say, 20 years ago. The stuff that I use every day and feel like I'm forced to use is 30 years old. So I don't know what that says, but I'm making some wrong choices.
I think for me, I'd say it's kind of some of the fundamental daily grind stuff that I use that is still the same. Like, one example is Apple Mail, which originally was the mail app on NextStep. I mean, it's evolved, it's changed, but, like, if you look at one version to the next, you know, NextStep became Mac OS X, and like it's a very clear sequence of things. There's probably code paths that I'm running through every day that were written in the 80s. I've been using it since 1990 for sure, maybe 1989 even. I'm not quite sure. So that's one thing.
I've been using it ever since Eudora went away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of when I switched over to Apple Mail. I've tried to go to, like, Google stuff and other things, but I keep coming back to Apple Mail.
Right. Yeah, to me, I always see, or not always, but now and then I'll see someone on Twitter complaining about the state of third-party iOS mail clients or third-party macOS mail clients. And I was just like, dude, Mail.app, it's there. Like, it's been, I've been using it, you know, every day for almost 30 years, and I've never seen a problem with it. Like, it just kind of works. It's not exciting. It's kind of boring, but I mean, I don't need to be excited about email. It's just a thing. I have to read and reply to. It's just like, I don't need bells and whistles, so it's fine.
I have long said when I retire, I'll finally be able to just give up email. I'm going to become one of those curmudgeons who says, nope, I'm opting out. I'm out. I have email just because I have to. And there's got to be a point in my life where I cannot have email. That'd be pretty sweet.
That will be a nice day. So for me, it's that. And then it's also just like Unix stuff, like Unix command line things that I also have been using since about 1990 that I'm still using every day. Just in terms of, like, you know, every time you open up a shell and you're typing, you know, LS, CD, all these things are just, you know, they come from originally the 70s, and we've been using them all the time since forever. Of course, there are variations.
I've been using a bash shell for, I think, since birth, is how it feels.
Yeah, so for me, it's those things. But other things, like you say, web browsers change, development environments change. I'm using Xcode, which is kind of the spiritual successor to Project Builder, which came before it. So I've kind of been using that since at least the 90s. But I don't know.
That's but I was a Code Warrior guy
forever.
So, and that is a last gone. So I like Xcode. I feel very comfortable in Xcode. So I have no actual complaints about it. I dig it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm on the same boat with you there. Like, I know a lot of people in the iOS developer community complain about Xcode in various ways. And it's like, yeah, there are some things that are missing. There's some things that I've seen in other environments that would be nice to have, and maybe we'll get them someday. But until then, ideal. It's all right. I've done a lot. I've had to do programming in far worse environments than this over my career. So it's like, yeah, it's okay.
Plus, people like Quinn have made things that can go in Xcode that make it incredibly lovely to create Apple II software. So Xcode is just a dream environment for making Apple II binaries now. So yay for that. Most other environments probably don't have that.
Yeah, well, particularly if you remember using Merlin.
Yeah, exactly. So big step up. I'm happy.
Cool. I'll have to look into that. I've not seen that stuff at all.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure out what I use. I did use BBEdit for a long time, but I'm kind of flaky in text editors. I keep hopping around to, like, the next one that does whatever snippets and code coloring and stuff. So so I haven't been too good with that. I think I was looking through my applications, one that I've had around for a long time is Default Folder, and that is it's a Mac thing, so it's not. In fact, I had looked it up, and now I've lost it again. But I think I've been using it since 97 or something, so it's old but not ancient. And it's basically a way to on the Mac open dialog to just gives you extra controls to kind of go back to where you used to be and go to favorites and things like that. Insane that it doesn't, you know, like, it still provides things now in Mojave that it doesn't natively have. But originally, I think there was another thing I think that competed with it called Boomerang back in the very old Mac Classic days, which was basically just, you know, when you hit open, instead of just starting at your desktop, it would go to wherever you last were.
I remember that.
Yeah. So I'm still using that. I'm still happy with it. I still get the updates every once in a while. Interarchy, I have in here, which is kind of from a similar age. I think it started as Anarchy, which I guess relates to, I can't even remember about now, but it was like Veronica and Archie. These were like search engines for FTP sites or something. Does that sound familiar?
Yes, it does.
Right.
So, and I believe that the Archie and Anarchy and later Interarchy comes from that. So I still have that, although that's had kind of a bumpy and rocky recent few years. So it got bought by somebody and then hasn't really been updated much. So.
And it's for, what is InterArchy for? Is it for?
It was an FTP client.
Oh, okay. I say it rang a bell, but I couldn't remember what it was because I think I used it at one point. I've been using Transmit for my FTP stuff for ages, and I really like it, which is also old, but not like, you know, 1980s old.
And it's panic, and everybody, you know, you have to, like, panic.
I used to, like, fetch. It took the longest time for me to move away from fetch just because of the icon. The fetch icon had this little dog with a floppy disk in its mouth, and I'm like, you know, you got me. You got me forever. I don't care how buggy you get. You're the best software. So it took a long time to pry that icon out of my cold, dead typewriter.
Yeah. I think it even still exists, but you know, things like Transmit and stuff are better.
Yeah, Transmit's so good. I finally moved over.
Honestly, I really use that most of the time. InterArchy, I still have in my folder, you know, in my applications folder, but I think it did some syncing that was slightly better at one point. So
I'm afraid to look at my application folder and see which things I've been just dragging from computer to computer to computer.
Right.
Who knows what would even happen if I tried to launch some of these things.
I'm pretty sure I have Maelstrom in here, but this is...
That will not work.
Well, it's some kind of updated one, I think.
Ooh, fancy man.
I played at that game a lot. Yeah, Ambrosia was good. I don't think they're still around, are they?
I think last time I looked at Ambrosia stuff, there were a site existed where you can download things, none of which worked. It seemed all the ones I was looking for didn't work on the current operating system. So that's my last vague memory of it. But I was a big fan.
Yeah, but yeah, I guess then and Jack already sort of covered the fact that the entire operating system came from the Next. But
right, and Ambrosia still. Looks like still a thing. So, cool.
Yeah, I mean, apart from the things that you mentioned, like Microsoft and Adobe things. I don't know. It is interesting, though, when you boot up a Next and look at the Windows and the Mail app, it is the same. Like, it's right. Surprising how it really just hasn't changed dramatically since then. You still kind of know how to use it, but all the clicking doesn't quite work the way you expect.
Right. Yeah, it's like you can look at Next Step Mail from 1990 and today's Mail on macOS, and you can kind of see, yeah, looks about the same. You know, it's not entirely like the modern Mail does have a different sort of list view that gives you an overview of messages in a different way, but like otherwise, it's pretty similar.
Yeah.
And back in those days, it was really exciting that you could have audio and pictures in your email.
You can what?
In your email message. You can have audio. You can have pictures.
Oh, burn the witch.
Carrington, you may have not ever seen this, but back then in the early Next Step things, there was like when you create a new account on a Next, you'd have a brand new account and it would have one single email message in your inbox automatically that was a message from Steve Jobs.
Ooh, I can sell that on eBay now.
With a bit of audio and it'd say, hi, this is Steve Jobs. Thank you for... using our Next computer or whatever it is. I don't know.
I did not know that. That's amazing. I'm going to seek that out so I can hear the message.
It's pretty crazy.
Hi, this is Steve Jobs. I want to welcome you to the Next World. We think you're going to love this computer. It's got the most advanced applications of any computer shipping today, and it's the first computer designed from scratch to be an interpersonal computer, to extend personal computing into the realm of improving group productivity and collaboration, which we think is going to be the most exciting thing happening in desktop computing in the first half of the 90s. So welcome to the Next World, and let us know what you think of your new computer.
I don't remember that. I'm sure I heard it once, but maybe only once.
I've tinkered around with a Next Step and an Xbox or an Xcube rather, but I didn't see it. That's amazing. That's cool. That's
very
cool.
It might have been something that they took away in later versions, but like in the first version, like the first one that I saw in 1989, it was there.
But I never had one that I set up from scratch. Like I played around on one that was like, here it is, a system all used and banged up. So
right. That's
super cool. And to talk about, to head back to Ambrosia for a second, it turns out, no, it doesn't exist anymore. Looks like it seemed to shut down in 2017 or so. The site I went to was on Internet Archive, not the actual site. So I get to click on the first Google response. So looks like the site was up through to January. So just the... company's been gone for a bit, but the January is when the site went down. So, alas, poor one out for Ambrosia and Maelstrom.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of the show. I really liked them. They had a bunch of things that I liked. Mm-hmm. Games and utilities.
Yeah, I think they had some sort of like audio capture stuff as well. So, all right. Maybe we can move on to the... I feel like there was something else I was going to say, but I can't recall it, so it'll come back at some other point.
Yeah.
All right, so I'll jump quickly and do a couple of... listener feeds back. Fabrizio on Twitter let us know of important developments in CrossChase, which is a wildly multi-platform game development library and also includes an example game. So CrossChase is the example game, I think. and CrossLib is for coding universal 8-bit games. And so this is a weird and amazing project. It's a super cross-platform thing. So let's see, he's got a list of the supported targets, and there are things like the Jupiter Ace, the Apple II, the Aquarius, the Mattel Aquarius, the Atari 5200, all of the Atari 8-bits, Commodore 64, Commodore, you know, CBM 510, Amstrad CPC, all kinds of like little ones as well. And the list just goes on and on and on. Like as I'm scrolling, I'm realizing it was silly for me to read any of them just because this list just keeps going. And so I think the idea is supposed to be that you can write little games, in fact, including even, you know, graphical elements that you can run on. You can basically compile to any of these machines, you know, so it's got some sort of, I find that even hard to imagine, but here it is. So it's definitely worth looking at. There's the README has a bunch of stuff, some pictures of the adaptive graphics and stuff, like, you know, how it goes to different machines and things, and, you know, images on ZX81s and on, you know, some more sophisticated computers. I think some of these are calculators, though, so...
Well, that's what I'm thinking. Like, the targets for this are so wildly diverse in what they offer at, like, the hardware level, and also, like, dealing with, like, sprites and stuff. How do you make a game thing that's going to work on the Apple II and the Atari 8-bits? Like, so either it doesn't use sprites, or it's creating a competing sprite engine that'll work on the Apple II, or it just says, too bad for the Atari, you got to have no sprites, or... How do you have anything beyond a beep? I can't imagine, but an 8-bit computer that has more than one sound sounds like heresy, but I hear that exists. So I don't know.
I think it's very much lowest common denominator in some sense. Like,
so calculator.
Yeah. What I've seen graphically of this, of the screenshots, it looks like it's all stuff that is either character graphics or like something where each character is mapped to a small bit map instead of a character. So I mean, essentially just like custom character graphics. It's not really, there's nothing here that I've seen that looks like anything like a sprite in any sense.
Which works fine for me because I don't really use any computers that have sprites in them, but
right.
It's hard to see how this will appeal to a developer who wants to target, say, the 8-bit Ataris.
Right.
Oh yeah, and I think the goal of this is to make things that you can run on any machine. Not if you actually wanted to write something for an Atari 8-bit, you would use something else.
Right. Yeah, it's more like if you have an idea that can be expressed in terms of just things moving around in a 40 by 24 grid, then here you go. Like you can do that kind of thing with this, which really encapsulates a lot of games. A lot of games work well in this. I don't remember the name of the developer, but I remember back on Palm OS, there was some developer who was like producing a vast number of games. It seemed like they were coming out games every week. They were all based on just what, you know, it could be this, essentially. It was all just kind of like things moving around on a grid with very, you know, simple animations and simple, you know, maybe a bit more than what this could do in terms of the way things looked. But in terms of the actual gameplay, it was all just very much things moving around from one box to the next. And like and the games this guy was making were there was quite a lot of variation. So I mean, I think there is potential to explore a lot of ideas around making games with something like this, but they're never going to be graphically impressive on any platform.
Yeah, but the reality is, if I'm making a game, it's not going to be graphically impressive anyway. So
see,
this isn't a limiting factor for me. Like for
exactly.
me, this is actually a lot of appeal. I'm just thinking for people who have more skills than I do, it might be an issue. But for me, this is right in my wheelhouse.
There you go.
Although it's usually the case that if you try to target a whole bunch of operating systems, you end up with something that isn't good enough for any of them. Like it's just like, cause people pick a computer cause they like that computer. So whenever I'm on like a modern computer, if I'm sitting on a Mac say, and I run a piece of software, it's really easy to tell that this wasn't for my computer. It was for a bunch of computers and it's just, you know, wiped away all the stuff that I like, the things that differentiate my computer. So there's pros and cons to this. But to create a game that you would run on a few different platforms, like if I'm making a game for the Apple II, odds are good it would work just as well on, say, a ZX80 or something. But I'm not going to go and make it for that. But this way I could create a game that would have a bigger audience. So I can see some real pros to this if it got working. Is it working? Mm-hmm. What's the status of this thing?
Oh, yeah, I think, well, so the way it's set up, the library is one thing, and then CrossChase is a game built against this library, so you can actually try this game out on all of these architectures in principle. So, it's working to the extent that this game exists on all these platforms.
That's pretty cool. That is pretty cool.
Yeah. It's quite possible. This seems like the kind of thing that would be fun to try. I mean, like, I'm not sure what the end goal is, except to have done it. But it still feels cool. So, and I don't think I've come across this before, so I'm glad that we got that notification. I don't actually know what the important development was that prompted the tweet, but it's possible that, you know, some more things have been added. It's under relatively active development. I mean, like 9 hours ago, as I look at this, is the last update on the repository.
Well, I know that I have mentioned this before on the show, so we have talked about it, but it's been a while. Don't sweat it,
man.
We
got feedback from somebody in Stockholm.
I can't remember things that were 3 days ago.
It's okay.
Cool. All right.
But it's definitely expanded a lot since then. We talked about it a couple of years ago, maybe, and it seems to be, like, looking at the list of platforms, I think it's a whole lot more than it was then. So. Interesting.
Okay. Progressing through the feedback, Quinn wrote on Twitter a couple of things. One was that the problem with running an Apple II on lemons is current. So you can get enough voltage for the 5 or 12 volt power source, but you can't move enough amps, she says. So I don't know. Oh, well. The dream is dying. and she actually, another thing that we talked about last time, she also tweeted us that about this idea we were sort of thinking about that had to do with sort of faking a floppy. So akin to those things that that can sort of fake a cassette deck out, you know, so sending signals to the head. And there apparently were a couple of these things. So Quinn linked us to a JVC floppy disk adapter multimedia card to 3.5-inch thing. And so I'll let you know what that's like when I get it. it looks like essentially a little SD card to, you know, a 3.5-inch floppy adapter. So I'm curious to see how well that works. Also, Brent sent us email talking about a different one that's kind of similar in concept called the Sony Mavica memory stick to 3.5-inch floppy adapter. And that one was at least specifically for the memory that comes with Mavica cameras, or Mavica. I don't know how you pronounce this. But so I think that one was more limited. My impression of the JVC one is that it actually is somewhat more general. So it would be interesting to see what it would work in. It may well not work in a Mac, but it might work in like a PC drive. So anyway, so we're too late to invent it. It exists already. But I'd still like to see it in a 5.25-inch. Version.
Especially one that was powered by lemons.
That's right.
What if, I think it's, okay, Quinn is supposedly smart about stuff, but has she considered, like, squishing the lemons? Like, so they're, like, really squishy? Because that might increase the power of a lemon? You don't know. You know how lemon magic works.
And I still think, what about just more lemons?
More lemons is the solution for a lot of things in my life. I'm gonna Google. I want to find out the average current of a lemon.
I mean, yeah, I can. Sure, maybe 100 lemons gives you 5 volts. But like, what if you had 100 million lemons? That ought to be enough to do anything.
Okay, so the average current of a lemon apparently is 0.001 amps. Okay, so we can work with this. And the voltage.
What do we need to get up to?
Hold on, the average. One potential difference. The average voltage for a lemon is 0.07 or 0.7 volts. That's a lot more volts than I would have thought. Okay, so you know what? Yes. So we need, we just need a couple million lemons.
They'll produce more volts than we need, but we'll just use a step-down transformer, right, to get it down
exactly.
to what we want.
Exactly, Quinn. You don't know what you're talking about. We're solving this right here now.
I'm so glad we figured this out.
Always works well when you go against Quinn on science stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure
we're just... to be on that side of that equation, right? Right?
I'm sure we're just right.
Why is nobody with me?
Excellent.
Yeah. I don't even know why I'm wrong, but I know I am.
I walk away from conversations with Quinn a lot. with that feeling. Like, okay, I don't even understand why I'm wrong, but I'm wrong. it's all so above my head. I can just come away with the impression that I'm wrong. I don't understand it. Punching above my weight here. Anyway, my solution still is more lemons. Always more lemons.
Excellent. Mm. Okay, and then I think the last bit of feedback I'm going to mention is actually a way to sneak an extra eBay auction in here, because Ian sent a link to an eBay auction for a very strange poster. Apple presents Computer Capers, and I forget what he said. He's something like he likes the poster, but it is a really weird thing. So everyone can take a look at that if you want. I don't know if we really need to comment on it now, but it seems like one of the most incoherent things I've ever seen.
Is this a legit old Apple thing?
I don't know. I assumed so, but that's...
But the Apple, I don't think so, because the Apple, in the word Apple beside Apple Presents, like the word Apple is in a font that Apple would not have used for their logo.
No, but maybe it's sort of comics-y.
Yeah.
Yes, but I still say no. Yes and yet no.
Yeah, I think this is a rogue department, but probably actually came out of Apple. But
they used Garamond.
It doesn't make any sense. It says Apple presents Computer Capers, and then it has all these little frames of things that don't seem like they have anything to do with capers. So, it's looking at a bent up bunch of pins on a plug saying, "Guess I shouldn't have forced it." I'm not sure where the caper is in that.
It talks about dust balls. Like attacking the computer is doomed. Armies of dust balls are invading through the holes that were poked through the vents.
Right, the which I guess is supposed to be telling you not vents? To. Yeah, don't poke the holes in the. Which are. Why would you do that? I mean, this must be on the. Why would you do that?
I think this is something that came out of like a Mad Magazine or like an Atari thing or something.
this is Atari propaganda against
it's
Apple.
Atari propaganda. Exactly.
Anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
Very weird. You can take a look at it and see what you think, but I can come away with no stable interpretation of this poster. All right. I think that'll do it for the feedback for now, though. And we can turn to the items of interest and of news. And Carrington, you have the first one.
My first one is an emulator. So to set the stage for this, people probably have heard of the emulator Wine. Like if you want to run Windows software, but you don't want to run a whole Windows instance, you can run Wine, which I have not run. But
should I interrupt you and say Wine is not an emulator?
What is Wine? What is the thing that lets you run Windows software?
Well, that's just what it stands for. I don't know what it is, but I think it stands for Wine is not an emulator.
Okay, so Wine is not an emulator. Right. Excellent. So... But it lets you run Windows software, say, on a Mac, I think, but you're not running all of Windows. You just want to run that app. That idea is now hopefully coming to the Mac OS. So there's something called Advanced Mac Substitute, which is a great name, which does essentially that. So if you want to run a piece of old Mac software, like from the 68K days, on a modern Mac OS 10 machine, this would be a way to do that. Like, and so you, it kind of bundles around the app and you run it. The app becomes a self launching thing that is just that one old app. It, I think right now is at the stage where it's shipping with like four apps as a proof of concept. So there's the Fool's Errand, a maze thing, Solitaire, and something else. So it looks like a version of, some game. I don't know what this game. Oh, it's an Atari game. Okay, so it's not Asteroids. The not Asteroids one.
Missile Command.
Missile Command is the word for it. Like, you know, not Asteroids. Meteorites, I guess it'd be. I think it sounds cool. I think it's still in the it's in the GitHub stage, and so I don't know how stable it is. I just like it as an idea. Like, so if you want to just quickly run an old game or something, I like things that offer the least amount of resistance to getting there. There's always the online version, like going to the Internet Archive, and so I'm a big fan of that. Like, so where somebody wants to run an old game, and however you can make it so they just have to double click an icon and it's working, that's always the goal. So I laud this as another way to kind of get to that state where you can have a, not even need to be on the internet now, you can have a, you know, self-contained little package, double click this, it's going to launch your game. And so I dig it. I dig it a lot. Those can be useful for playing old games, but they can also be useful for if you've got, we were talking about like the oldest software we've ever run. So if you've got like a really old version of something, you got a ClarisWorks file lying around and you're not sure how to open it, using an emulator like this that could let you say, just open up ClarisWorks, not have to install a bunch of other things, just basically open up the app in a stable enough version to be able to load an old file and then resave it as text or something or copy the data out of it. That can also be really useful. So they're useful not just for games. So I dig it. I don't know how stable it is, but it is available for download and play, and there's at least 4 games you can play. So I thought it was pretty cool. So it's Advanced Mac Substitute. We'll have a link to that and also to an Ars Technica write-up about it.
Cool.
And from now on, I'm calling Missile Command Meteorites.
Okay.
Or Not Asteroids.
Or I'm just going to call it Not Asteroids, yes.
It doesn't quite work in Mojave, so it doesn't work in the most recent.
A lot of things don't.
Yeah. My computer, actually, I haven't bothered to bring it that far up anyway, so it would work on mine. But I don't know. See, I mean, I guess so. The idea, I guess, is that you could do this instead of something like Basilisk 2 or something. Instead of emulating a whole
right,
machine.
Or Mini VBAC, which is my go-to emulator for old vintage, like 512 pixel Macintosh stuff when I want to run something in OS 6 or OS 7. So,
right.
Oh, I guess it wasn't OS. What was it called then? Mac OS 6?
System
6 or 7. Ah, my goodness. I spent so many years in it, you think I'd remember. But I remember so very little. Who are you people?
I'm pretty sure that Mini VMac is for 68K things. Well, like maybe this is too, actually.
Yeah, like the pre-Intel stuff.
Right. My experience with all of those little emulator box things is that it winds up being kind of difficult to get stuff in and out. So actually getting things from your hard drive to something it can see or vice versa.
Screenshots.
What?
Everything's done with screenshots.
Right.
Got a whole bunch of text, just shoot it all and then pull it over into a piece of software to run OCD on it or whatever. OCR, not OCD.
Straighten up all those letters, man.
Quite straight.
Okay. Anyway, interesting. I'll be interested to see where that goes. I will probably try to run it and see how quickly I can generate a kernel panic on my computer.
Well, that's a fun game in itself.
Right. Dodge the kernel panic.
Oh, have you? Speaking of which, Kevin Savitz, who we like to mention on this show, has been entering into that 10-line basic contest that is ongoing right now, and he does every year. He has an entry into it this year that I think is the funniest thing ever. So it's a version of Peg. You know the game where you roll the dice and you can keep accumulating and you get a score, but if you roll snake eyes, then you're out. So it's basically, you roll the dice and it's a risk thing. Lots of versions of it exist. Zombie dice is basically a version of it. Those sort of things. He made one called like Poke Pig or something. And the idea is every time you run, it pokes a bit of data randomly into memory. And the idea is to go as long as you can before you take down the system. I think it's hilarious.
That's very cool.
Yeah. Great idea. Well executed. It's very funny.
Yep, I've seen that on Twitter. It does seem hilarious.
I like it. So, Jack, what do you have here?
Yeah, speaking of which, the basic 10-liner contest is
underway.
I guess
I could look down in our notes.
So, the contest Carrington just mentioned, the annual contest is underway. The deadline is March 30th to get your entries in. And as usual, they have several different categories in terms of like, what does 10 lines of basic code mean? So they have a category called Pure 80, Pure 120, and Extreme 256, which are basically just variations of how many characters may exist on a logical line. So, and you can submit things that work for any emulatable 8-bit platform. And I keep meaning to do this and haven't done it, but maybe this year I will. Seems like it could be fun.
As an Apple II guy, we are at such a disadvantage here because of things like sprites and stuff. Like, you can do a lot more in 10 lines with something like an Atari 8-bit or like a later 8-bit than, you know, the late 70s tech of the Apple II.
Well, even on the Ataris, you can't really do much with sprites in BASIC at all without machine language. And this contest, like, it specifically says you're not allowed to use machine language in your BASIC programs. So it's only what you can actually do in the language itself. But like,
well, I like it.
I guess the Atari maybe has a little better drawing commands that work in BASIC. Maybe. I don't know. They're not great either. But I don't know. People do a lot of interesting stuff on a lot of platforms. It's always fun to look at this. So I'm going to maybe try and do something. And speaking of Kevin Savitz, I noticed one of the things he did that he also posted about was he made another program in 10 lines of BASIC just to help him write other 10-line BASIC programs. Like, he made a program that helped him do generate, like, custom font characters, which you can use for graphics. And he wrote that program in 10 lines of BASIC code. It's getting very meta here.
Awesome.
Go, Kevin. I was reminded of, I only sort of vaguely remember this, and I didn't have quite enough time to completely read and digest it here, but there's an article that we will have the link in the show notes to it. It is Real Life Tron on an Apple IIgs, and perhaps, we probably talked about this before, but essentially, as I recall the story, this is someone who's basically, you know, watched Tron and made a little, like, snake-type light cycles game, except that what ended up happening is that something about the collision detection got messed up in it, and you could run the cycle off the screen, at which point it just starts, like, you know, cruising around in memory.
which is just like the movie. That's amazing.
Yeah. So it did actually remind me quite a bit of the, whatever it is, pig poke.
Nice.
So, and there's a little bit of a write-up by our very own Ken on the Apple IIbits site, too. Well, maybe I'll put that link there, too. Okay, let's see. I think I am next. There are a number of things. In the show notes, I put this down as Big Mesa News, but because there's a couple of things that have been announced by Big Mesa Wires, and I just figured I would consolidate them into one item. So one of them was that a couple of these news items are essentially that Steve Chamberlain has decided to let a couple of these projects go. So one of them is that the Yellowstone disk controller card that he had been designing, it's not getting anywhere just because he hasn't had time to sort of deal with it. It's basically supposed to be a replacement for one of the cards that interfaces with the... It creates a smart port and allows you to talk to the 3.5-inch drive on the older Apple IIs that didn't have the smart port. So it's kind of a cool thing. Possibly other things that could have been done with this card, but it was basically just sitting stagnant for long enough that he just said, all right, it is now in the public sphere. It's under Creative Commons attribution license. Build it, fix it, make it work. He pointed out one of the things he hadn't figured out, and so I don't know if it'll be easy to figure out what he was unable to, but at least someone else can try if they want. By the way, I should maybe mention, and this I'll tie this into the other one. Big Mesa Wires is the manufacturer, the name of the company that Steve Chamberlain works under. They make the floppy Emu. So this is basically a 3.5-inch floppy drive emulator that works on the Mac, on the Lisa, on the Apple II, on basically all of these old Mac things. Anything that has that kind of a connector. Well, actually, also anything that has a connector for an Apple II Disk II. I think that's right. I think you can use either kind. So it's a super versatile thing. It's wonderful. And he has added disk support for the WAS disk images that the AppleSauce software can make. So we've talked repeatedly about the AppleSauce Flux Imager. And the eventual outcome of taking a Flux image of a floppy disk for like an Apple is that you get a WAS image, and the floppy Emu can now read WAS images, which means you can use a protected disk on an Apple II or on an Apple III, I think. That was to connect the both of those stories. The Yellowstone card, or the, you know, the original Apple Lyron card, is supposed to plug into a 3.5-inch disk so that actually the Yellowstone card and the floppy Emu would plug together in order to go into a Apple II or Apple III or something. So the WAS support is very cool. That means that I will be able to image Apple III disks and test to see if they worked without having to figure out how to crack them. So that's cool. In fact, might actually work with 3.5-inch disks on Macs too. So maybe to whatever extent you can protect Mac disks. I mean, it's somehow. I know sometimes they were protected.
Only through security by obscurity.
Yeah. I was surprised actually how close in format the Mac disks are to the Apple II disks. I sort of figured they were just some magic black box, but a lot of the stuff is still the same, you know. Anyway, whatever. The last bit of Big Mess of Wires news is that they had something called a Rominator or Rominator 2 that would let you basically swap out ROMs in your classic Macs. I think it was a way to put like 32-bit clean ROMs in a SE30 type machine and that kind of thing. Might be wrong, but it's something like that. And essentially, it depended on a type of FPGA or something that's no longer easy to get. So he's basically retiring the project.
I'm actually super sad about that because I didn't take my own advice that I've said on this so many times, which when something is created, like, go get it. For some reason, like, I always intended to buy one of these things because if I got an SE30, I would want to put one of these in there because it gives you HD20 support. It gives you mainly like a 32-bit clean ROM, so it's going to raise the ROM ceiling, just like the default stuff that comes with it. And well, sure, you could use it to change the ROM. I was just more interested in this was a great pop-in ROM that would just disable like the memory test on startup if you wanted, so it would be much faster for booting. Like just a bunch of things that would be really nice to have to just sweeten something like an SE30 or an SE. And I just never got around to buying them, and now they're gone. And I'm like, oh, that was disappointing.
yeah,
my own fault.
There in the little write up, it does say something about there being. I mean, so I think the ones that Big Mess Wire sold actually were somewhat user updatable if you were, you know, fancy. but there is some mention of someone else selling things that are just ROM. So
yeah, I think there's other ROM things. It's just I like Big Mess of Wires. You know, it's just one of those things where I could have supported this. I it's a product that I wanted. I have no idea why I never got around to buying it.
Yeah.
And I know it hasn't shut down because of lack of support. It shut down because the product is basically not available anymore. It's just disappointing. Like it's a reminder that you should jump on things if you want them because they go away.
Indeed. All right. And now it is your turn. So
me, you say. Okay, so there's a new alpha out for something that I don't know if we've talked about before. I have a vague memory about, but I don't know why. It's something called the Apple II desktop. Now, there were Apple II era desktop organizer things, like, you know, Mac-like front ends. There was Mouse Desk, and I vaguely remember something called Apple Desktop 2, I think, but then, which was also Ultimate Desktop. I don't know, I'm very vague on these, but there's a new alpha for the Apple II desktop, which is one of these things. So on your Apple II, I guess GS, but 2E or 2C, you can run this, and now you've got a graphical front end to your Apple II. It's not necessarily something I'd want to have. Like, I'm an 8-bit Apple person. I haven't even really embraced ProDOS, so I'm super old school when it comes to these things. I'm a DOS 3 guy. But still, like, this is really neat. And so you can use this on your Apple II to use a mouse, to use icons. So it's kind of cool. I have a vague memory that this was discussed or mentioned or dealt with at Kansas Fest. I don't know. It's all very vague. But I saw news that a new alpha is out. And it's always nice to talk about software for vintage computers that's currently in development in case somebody has some interest and they want to contribute. So I'll have a link to the Apple II desktop GitHub repository. It's an alpha, like super alpha. So, you know, your mileage may vary in how much it crashes for you hourly or minutely or whatever. But maybe you want to contribute. Maybe you can, you know, help make this be a stable, cool thing. I think it's really neat. And I know very little about it other than the screenshots of it look cool. And it's sweet that somebody can show that even on an old, like 1 megahertz 2C, you could really have a very snappy, very cool GUI for it.
Yeah. So that's what I got. I will have to try that out at some point. It's true, though. Same with the 2GS. I don't use GSOS. It always feels like a slow Mac to me. And I'm sure if I got used to it, then I would embrace it. But because I came to the Mac first and even I skipped the 128K because it was too slow, it really does feel quite limiting.
Me too. And for the GSOS always feels to me like it's a wrong Mac in the same way that early Windows felt. Like, you know, you get used to your version of something. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the GS1 is wrong or inferior. It's just not what I was used to. But for me, weirdly, one of the things that turned me off it was the same thing that turned me off early Windows is I got used to early Macintosh, jumped on the Mac very early. So the look of certain items, like the width of a character and the angle and width of, say, a mouse pointer looks very wrong to me on things like early Windows, in fact, modern Windows, and GSOS. Like the mouse pointer just looks wrong. It's too skinny. It's too tall. What's up with your mouse pointer? Right. And it's those aesthetic things just make it all feel wrong to me for some reason. So it's weird little aesthetic things that kept me off it more than anything else.
Let's see. So, Jack, we were speaking of cross development before. This is a true adventure in cross development.
Yeah, so this is pretty interesting. So Eduardo on Facebook sent this to us. Basically, this is a YouTube video of someone doing cross development for a 2600 game using a Commodore 64 as the development environment and a StarPath supercharger to transfer it over. So the supercharger was an accessory for the 2600 that let you basically have sort of better or more bigger games primarily for the 2600 than what it normally could allow. Basically, we had this device. You'd plug in the cartridge port, and it had a cable to run to a cassette tape. And so they would distribute games on cassettes. So you could have a game that would like load some stuff from the cassette, and you'd play that for a while, and maybe like the next level loads more data from the cassette. The technical details of how that works are kind of... I've never actually used one. I remember it from back in the day. But basically what it lets you do is, as long as you have an audio stream coming in over that wire that contains data that the StarPath supercharger knows how to decode and turn into something that the 2600 sees as a ROM, then off you go. And so someone is doing this using this thing called Assembloids, which is a newish homebrew that came out for the 2600 a couple of years ago probably. And so they're looking at the source code for this on a C64 and then on there assembling it and transferring it via an audio cable over to the 2600. So they demonstrate doing some things and making some changes in the source code and transferring it back over. Looks pretty neat. I mean, if you can handle sitting and working on a C64 all day as your development environment, then right. Then why not? But like, yeah, it's an interesting mix of things. And so basically, it involves some software on the C64 that is both. So there's both an assembler and there is something that will take the assembled code, transfer it into the right sort of audio signal going out something to connect to the StarPath supercharger. And I haven't actually watched every bit of this, but probably what it does, it probably uses the cassette interface on the C64, which was also, you know, that's how you could save and load software on that, apart from a floppy drive, was with a cassette. So it probably uses that in some way to send the data out.
I think it does. And I'm not exactly sure how the cassette works on the C64, but I think it does actually make use of the SID chip. So It might actually be coming out an actual sort of like speaker out.
Right. But. Yeah, it makes sense. So that probably is how it works. I guess I never even knew anyone who used a cassette on the C64. So back in my friend group, they were all on floppies. So I don't really know, but I expect that it was, that seems like probably the case. So anyway, it's interesting. It's kind of a cool little hack and like an interesting way that like you look at this and think that in theory somebody could have done this in 1983 or whenever the C64 came out and made their own little development environment for the 2600. But it's done now. Yeah. There it is. So could be a fun thing for people to play with, and it's pretty fun to look at also.
It's actually it does seem like you could. I mean, you know, it's less cool, but it would be. You could still kind of hook up like Xcode to some sort of audio out thing that would feed into the same thing.
Yeah, good. Let's see, why not? I mean, you could look at whatever this thing is doing and do something similar. Like, however the audio works on these devices, at least on the C64, it's pretty well documented and understood how audio was produced and presumably how the cassette works. I would say I would think that if anything, the StarPath supercharger is perhaps a little less known and documented, you know, what it expects to receive. But I don't know. I may be wrong. Anyway, it made me think twice because I just happened to see a supercharger for sale here locally the other day, and I might actually grab it from the person. We'll see.
Yeah, I had my eye on that for a little while. I don't have one at the moment, but for a while I was looking for them, and then, I don't know, I got distracted.
Sure.
All right. I guess that's it for the news. Oh, that's cool. Yeah. In our show notes, it says VCF East dates are known, but not by me. And that's because I didn't update it. And I think the dates are known.
But still not by you.
Okay. So VCF Pacific Northwest 2019 is getting very close. So that is March 23rd and 24th in wherever that is.
Seattle, Washington. The Living Computer Museum.
Yeah. That sounds pretty Pacific and Northwest.
It does. Looks like VCF East will be May 3rd to 5th at the InfoAge Science Center in Wall, New Jersey.
Oh, you know, in fact, that may have even made it into the show notes last time because I think that was announced between when we recorded and when I put the episode out.
Oh, cool.
That's cool. All right.
I would actually have one more that I can add in here that I didn't mention before, or I didn't know the date before. Retro Gathering in Västerås here in Sweden, not that far from Stockholm, is going to be on Saturday, February 23rd. And this is the thing where they have two different events. They have one in the fall that is focused on games, and the one in February is focused on vintage computers. It's the vintage computer edition of Retro Gathering. And I've actually not been to this. I've been to the game one, but I haven't been to this one. But I probably would go to this one now in a few weeks on Saturday the 23rd. We'll have a link to that.
That too. Sounds fun.
I think it will be. I think when I've been there before, there have been plenty of computers also, but in terms of the content of what, when they had speakers and such, it was all focused mainly on the gaming side of things. So we need to see what is different when they actually are focused on computers.
All right. That's good enough. Now a word from our sponsor.
Last year, this Atari. Now the kid wants a computer. Better idea. The supercharger from StarPath. Don't cost much. Plug it in the Atari and play supercharger computer games that cost under 15 bucks each. And the supercharger comes with this phaser patrol game. Rocket stuff. And the kid can fight those commie mutants from space. Because they're out there.
Available at fine stores everywhere.
And we're back. And so this time for the host's retro computing gift idea, once again, I'm going to deny all responsibility because I didn't pick it, because I actually don't know that much about it. But I'm alone on this podcast of not knowing about it. This is the Max Headroom, the complete series box set. So surely everybody knows of Max Headroom, at least. And this is a complete, I think it did a DVD box set that contains the complete series. Carrington, you said you have this.
I do indeed. Yeah, there were two seasons, so it was only, I think, 14 episodes totally. There's not a lot of Max Headroom, but it was great. So Edison Carver, reporter for Network 23, and it's a typical thing from the 80s, which says it's slightly in the future, and therefore it's basically a post-apocalyptic wasteland. The 80s just assuming apocalypse was coming any minute now. The crazy thing about that decade. And it's just cool. So a lot of people might only know Max Headroom as that weird animated character that sold Coca-Cola, but it was also a TV show. And the idea is the reporter smacks into a barrier that says Max Headroom. So that's his last, everybody, his brain got downloaded into a computer. So he survives, but then there's a version of him as this glitching smart alecky computer thingy. And they solve crimes in an investigative reporter sort of way. Well, not really crimes, but, you know, stuff in the post. About it's fun. Anyway, I like it. It's good.
I think they solved capers.
They solved capers.
Perfect. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I've seen, like, part of the first episode or something like that, but I never quite made it through. But, yeah, the character was everywhere due to Coke, but also there was some sort of musical collaboration with Art of Noise, I think, that was also on the radio all the time. So.
Yep. And like cyberpunk really took off. And this is like one of the early cyberpunk TV type things. So it was like of its time very much. So
I remember that I watched it when it was new. I probably saw most or all of it. And I remember that I liked it, but I can't remember, I remember much more, but it was 30 whatever years ago. But yeah,
I don't know how well it's aged.
We'll see.
But I liked it at the time a lot, so we will see how awful and sexist it is if you watch it with modern eyes. You never know with these things, but at the time I really liked it. Let's see what I was blind to with a rewatching.
Perfect. Yeah, actually, what's been kind of funny is seeing the actor show up in other things, you know, because for a long time he was just solidified in my mind as the Max Headroom guy, But even in the Max Headroom makeup, you know, it's clear enough who he is. So
yeah, Matt Frewer. Yeah.
Yeah. So he shows up in, somewhat recently in Orphan Black, and he was in Timeless, and there's a bunch of things that show up on TV, and he's just in them. It's like, I don't know. It's very pleasing somehow.
I think of him as the Lawnmower Man 2 guy, but also Max Headroom. But yeah, he's been in like a hundred things or something. So.
Yeah, I'm flipping through Wikipedia's list, and it's long like the platforms of the cross chase. Okay. Anyway, I guess we didn't say the link goes to an Amazon sales site, but of course other people probably sell it as well. On Amazon, it appears to be $35, so it's not a great commitment. But okay, we can now turn to eBay now that we are all experts on eBay. And Carrington, you have the first bunch.
Yeah, I picked two. I went mini Paul, not full Paul, but mini Paul. So the first I'm picking is a Frieden FlexoWriter, which is a punch tape processor. And these things always appeal to me. Like, I have no use for one. I would never actually buy one. But usually when you see something like this, like basically it looks like a typewriter, but it's designed to punch holes in tape. So you look at any card writer or any punch tape writer, they typically look like they were in a barn for 50 years, because they typically were in a barn for 50 years. They'll be covered in dust and dirt and grime, and you'll look at them, look at the eBay listing, and they'll say, it's $200. Trust me, under this pile of brown, there's some sort of typewriter, and they're terrible. So this one's more expensive than the typical punch tape thing that will come by, so it's $900. Well, $899.99. And I don't know if that's worth it or whatever, but what I liked about this is it looks nice. Like, it looks like something that could be being used right now. It says it's tested to the point of power on. I don't know what you'd do with one of these things. If Earl was here, he'd probably be telling us, yep, here's why this is cool. And like, this is kind of more up his alley. But you have the little spool on the one side that will be your tape, and you would hit a typewriter. And what the nice thing about the FlexoWriters is the Flexo part of it is they were designed to be able to use manually. So you put a tape in and you use it like a typewriter to code your tape that way, or they could be hooked up to a computer and be used as a printer. So that's thus Flexo. So they're cool. The Flexo writers have always been the punch tape writer of choice for me, but I also choose to not have one. But if I was to have one for some weird reason, it would be this one. So it was neat to see a really nice looking one pop up on eBay that looks like it's actually working, and it comes with a dust cover. And honestly, everything has been downhill since we stopped using dust covers. So it's of a good era. So that's my first choice. Presumably you guys don't have a lot to contribute, or you don't have one of those, right? Just good pause, just in case.
Nope.
Not going to say, yeah, I got two.
I have one. I can't imagine finding a place for it.
Right, but look around your office, Paul. Be sure. Okay. So my second choice is another thing that I would choose not to have, but that I really like. So I'm going with a theme here. Things that I like and appreciate, but dear Lord, I have no use for and wouldn't actually ever make space for. And in this case, it's a daisy wheel printer. I love daisy wheels. I like them so much. I like them more than dot matrix printers. I don't care that they're not as useful. I like the pristine type. I love a daisy wheel. But a lot of times when daisy wheel printers come up, they are the wide format ones. Most people save those. 90% of the nice looking daisy wheels that come up are wide format ones. And like, who's got space for that, man? No. So what's nice is this is your typical one that can take a letter size paper and that's it. You maybe be able to turn it sideways. I don't know. So I like the dimensions of it. But what caught my eye was a couple of things. One, it's in lovely condition. It's a silver reed, which is from the Silver Seiko brand. Now, Silver Seiko was just a manufacturer. So you see a lot of things were made by Silver Seiko, but they were like just this company that made other people's stuff. And so sometimes they'll say Silver Seiko on it, but really you'll normally see another brand. And then on the bottom on the label, it'll say Silver Seiko. And I've always been interested in this as a company because they made a lot of neat things that I never had back in the day, but often catch my eye now. So a lot of people use them as their manufacturer. So this is a Silver Reed EXP400. It's a nice looking looks like brand new. I think it's a never used parallel port daisy wheel printer in a good size. So I dig that a lot. But what really caught my eye was the fact that it's a Silver Seiko manufacturer, because Silver Seiko did make something that I do own, even in my minimalist apartment of concrete and nothingness and echoes that's so difficult to podcast in. I have a couple of things. There are a few things that I own. And one of the few weird, useless things I own in my mini Paul collection is a 1971 1 Royal Swinger, Royal Swinger typewriter, which is my favorite typewriter ever. Now, while it's called a Royal, they're only just using that word to make it, because Royal was a famous typewriter manufacturer that's super collectible. This isn't one of those. This was a Silver Seiko machine made in, I think, 1970 and 71. I have the 71 version. It comes in this beautiful blue and an off-white cream color that I think is gorgeous and typewriter collectors think is garish and awful. So I'm out of step with typewriter people. But my pick for the best typewriter ever made is a Silver Seiko 1971 Royal. And why it's gorgeous is it's this sleek 70s style. It's a manual typewriter. It's beautiful and has in its gorgeous blue lid a built-in AM radio. And I think that is the coolest feature. Oh, no. So you can go out to the park, you take your lid off, you tune in your AM music, and you type away on the great American novel. I just love it. I think it's the most gorgeous, most 70s thing. It's so 70s. It's beautiful.
Oh,
so I love
God.
The industrial design. It's one of the things that I own and cherish, but don't actually use. Except I do occasionally turn on the radio and I make sure the batteries are nice in it. So it's gorgeous. So Silver Seiko, manufacturer that is dear to my heart, made the Silver Reed EXP 400, not dear to my heart, but my eBay choice because it's a cool looking. So if you're looking for a fine, not big daisy wheel printer, then I would recommend the Silver Seiko or the Silver Reed that I have no experience with. But hey, Silver Seiko steered me right with their typewriters, so they got to be good with these wheels. So that's what I say. That's my pick.
That's amazing. Is the AM radio in the typewriter body or
no,
in
it's
the case?
No, it's in the lid. So there's a lid that snaps over top of the typewriter, like your dust lid. Mm-hmm. And so it's built into that. So the switches are on the outside, so you can turn on it. And any time, it's also just sitting there as a very large AM radio. But when you want to use the typewriter, you take the lid off and you prop it up and it becomes your AM radio separate. And then you type away. And it's joyous to work on. I absolutely love it. So we'll have a link in the show notes also to a typewriter database that has some nice shots of exactly my model. So the Royal. There were two versions. If you're going to seek this out, one thing to know about the Silver Seiko Royals is there were actually three versions of this story. There's the Silver Seiko Swinger, because you want to get the Swinger, and the Swinger is the one that has the AM radio in it. There was also something I think called a Swift or something
related?
Like that. Well, probably. So there's the exact same typewriter with the exact same lid that with the grill, but it doesn't have the built-in AM radio. And it's called the Royal something else. I think it's called the Royal Switch. Anyway, it's not Swinger. On the typewriter itself, up by the where the paper carriage thing is, it'll say the word Swinger or say another word with S. If it's not Swinger, it doesn't have the radio. However, there's also one, if the blue and cream gorgeousness isn't the color you're looking for and what you want to embrace is full fake wood trim, then there's also the 1970 Royal Fleetwood, same typewriter. They came both with and without an AM radio, and where it's blue on mine instead is a fake sticker that looks like wood paneling. So that also exists, but I don't find it quite as attractive as the blue and cream because it's super space age looking. So there you go. Typewriter that I love and I own and I just adore. It's one of my favorite things that I possess.
That is, you know, and actually the radio thing, I have this sort of vague memory like that. I wouldn't have ever come up with that, but I think I might've encountered that before too. It's a weird pairing, but I suppose you can sort of imagine it as a mobile workstation. You know, exactly,
yeah.
Like going in.
And also, just it's nice to have. Like as a minimalist, I like things that do more than one job. So having a typewriter that's also a radio is great. Now, unfortunately, it's a very bad AM radio, so it's not the greatest because it has two little thumb dials, one for volume and one for tuning, and it's like a little tiny dial, so it's very hard to tune in precisely to AM, and there's not a lot of AM around anymore. Oh, it also has a headphone jack, so you can listen with it. I think they originally came with one of those white wires that goes to a single earbud, like a mono headphone thing, so it came with one of those, but I don't have that, so. But it's
where
gorgeous.
The plug says ear.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, it's technically they're called the Royal 260, I think was the model, but I just know it as the Royal the Royal Swinger. I love everything about it. Love the color, love the name, love the radio, love like it's so perfect. It's so beautiful. I think typewriter collectors think it's an aberration and horror. So they go really cheap. Like you can pick one of these things up for nothing because no serious typewriter fan likes these things and they're all wrong. But my actual choice is this daisy wheel printer.
Okay.
Even though I spent all my time talking about a typewriter that is not currently on eBay.
I think they look kind of nice. Maybe that means they'd be a bad typewriter collector.
Exactly. No, typewriter collector is a bad typewriter collector. Right. Everyone wants these like massive 500-pound Royals and stuff from the 1940s. And who wants to lug one of these things around? This is a beautiful, not heavy, gorgeous, sleek-looking 1970s built-in AM radio typewriter. Like, what more could you want from a typewriter? Come the apocalypse, I will still be able to type. And if somebody needs to tell me that there's still life on the planet, they can get me on their AM broadcast. Like, this is going to save my life one day, man.
That's right.
You wait. You wait and see.
All right.
Awesome.
Let's see. So I will move on to a few things that I have. So the first one, I thought this was just kind of interesting. It's a Commodore PET 2001 user's guide. So the seller sold the PET some time ago, accidentally forgot the manual. So here's the manual. And it's, you know, its current bid is $9.99. So it's, you know, basically going to go for whatever the market is. And I don't know if it's interesting or not, but I think it's kind of cool that it's the actual thing, and it looks like it's in good shape. So it has a little bit of
rating. I think a lot of times if you pick up a PET on eBay, it's not going to come with the manual.
Right.
So nice. And I like an auction that just says it's $10 and I'll get what I get.
Yeah. And maybe that'll be it. I don't know. But I think I bet this is a pretty rare object, actually. Yeah. As you say, the PETs you find don't often have them. Okay, the next thing is a Kensington mouse holder, which I thought was kind of cool. It is specifically to put on the side of your, like, 128K Mac to hold your mouse. It's a little mouse holster.
I remember seeing this. I don't remember where I saw it, but somebody I knew had this. So you could stick your mouse up on the side of your Mac when you were not using it, just to hang it up in there.
Everyone
was used to telephones at that point, right? So that's what you do.
I guess.
I'm done. I'm going to hang up my mouse. This is great. And all it is a little plastic thing. So this is something that could be 3D printed now. This could make a comeback.
It's true. It's true. But it's totally, you know, it's in the style of the mouse itself. So it would be actually nice if they showed a picture. They don't. It's possible that this seller doesn't actually have a mouse to test it out with. But,
And you can see how the back of it has stuck on it like half of a Velcro strip. So the other half, no doubt, got stuck on your Mac, and that's how it attached. So That's easy enough to do now. There's going to be a 3M Velcro thing you could stick on the side of a classic Mac, and you could attach this. And if it's one of those command strip type things, you'd easily be able to take it off later without damaging the computer. So this is a nice little addition to a classic Mac that wouldn't damage or permanently modify the classic Mac. So I like it a lot. It's a great choice.
Actually, and realistically, it actually would save some desk space while you're, you know, not using it.
Oh, you're talking me into it.
All right.
I have two comments about the presentation of this. One, red velvet is lovely. All photos should have red velvet in the background because this is beautiful.
I agree.
The seller also graciously shows us that the inside of this mouse holder looks kind of filthy.
Yeah.
Like there's like dirt down in there that he has not bothered to clear away before photographing this and selling it. I like it.
You're right. So there's four photos. First three photos are gorgeous product shots against red velvet. Fourth photo, big hairy hand showing the inside is filthy. Oh, wow. That's a bit of a come down. Season four of this series is not as good as the first three.
Okay. The next one is a Advanced Gravis Mac mouse stick with GMPU. The mouse stick GMPU. And so I don't know that much about this. I saw, you know, I think I might actually have one of the joysticks, but I saw one of the GMPU at Kansas Fest last year, maybe. But essentially, I think what it is a joystick, you know, that is treated by your Mac as a mouse, right? So, and what's cool about this is it actually comes with all the pieces, you know, so the joystick and the processor box and the manual and the disk. So,
wait, so you use the joystick to move the mouse pointer around? Like you're going to fly the mouse pointer around the Mac?
That's my assumption.
Oh, I'm going to be super productive with this thing.
Right. Yeah.
Now, I guess you can make airplane noises all day at your work. It'd be amazing.
That's right.
Sorry, boss, just flying the mouse.
Uh, if you want to kind of bring people around to the idea that they should let you telecommute.
Yeah. It's also not necessarily a reason to write into the show to say that I have no idea what an airplane sounds like, because that's apparent to everyone. You're not smart for pointing that out. I don't know. I know so very little. I think Gary convinced his story.
Anyway, so what I most found interesting about this, I think, besides the fact that it is a thing that exists, is just that it is complete, you know, so... it's easy to find pieces of this. Like, the things that were at Kansas Fest were pieces of this. I think maybe both parts of this were there, but I'm not sure that they were on the same table, you know? Mm-hmm. So, okay, the next one is... So this is kind of cool. It's a Apple III license plate. You know, it's a brown license plate that has an Apple on it. It says Apple III. And apparently this is something that was given to employees and not actually sold. And, you know, so that's the thing that caught my attention. Not even as something that I was necessarily going to put in the show notes, but if you read the description, it says basically like these were let's see, I've acquired a large collection of vintage Apple computer items. The gentleman they came from was a manager at Apple Computers from 78 to 88. And then at the end of this set of photos is three photos, which are included on all of the relevant auctions from the seller, of like a room full of like Apple stuff that is eventually going to go on eBay. So you can get sort of previews of things that you will see. And it's quite a bunch of stuff there.
Uh-huh. Holy moly. So, one of those light-up Macintosh signs, desktop signs, which I think are really sweet. So cool. Uh-huh. But a lot of stuff. So with an Apple III license plate, so I guess in the States, there are some states where you only put a plate on one part of your car, right?
Mm. Yeah, I think
so. Here in Ontario, you have to have an actual license plate on both front and back. But I think some of them in America, you only need it on either just the front or just the back.
Just the back in some states, it depends.
Okay, so yeah, so you'd be able to use this as a front license plate. Though the obvious joke, of course, is if you put this on a car, you're going to have to drop it. So you have to run it on a lowrider, right?
Yeah, and ultimately, I think, you know, the idea of putting a collectible plate in the front doesn't sound like a great one, but...
Well, you put one of those license plate protector things on the front.
Yeah, I suppose one could do that.
Hmm. My license plate on my car is 6502.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Very nice.
So I'm a fan of the chip.
But yeah, it's quite delightful to just sort of like look through this photo and try to identify what everything is. And, you know, it's quite possible that the things that I don't have that are in this photo are going to be very costly to get. But it's at least interesting to know that they're there. Mm-hmm. It's also possible that, I don't think I'm going to do this, but one could contact the person ahead of time and say, well, look, I really would like to have that thing. How can we make that happen?
Yeah, sure. Put the photos in there maybe for that.
I saw the same seller is trying to sell an Apple computer necktie for $150.
Well, there's a bunch of clothing in the photo of all the stuff. Like there's a,
yeah, that's
there's
one of
a
the things.
Stand with a bunch of clothing on hangers. So maybe
this is the necktie hanging cool in the front, and he has a separate auction for just that already.
Right.
Okay. So. And I can see as a seller, like it's a pain to sell this much stuff to have to list it all and box it up and ship it. So
sure.
I can see the appeal if you're the seller on this and someone proactively contacts you and says, look, you've got 10 things in this photo I'd like to take. What would you take for those 10? And we'll just get those out of the way now. Even if you make a little less off it as a seller, it stops you having the headache of having to do the listing. So it's certainly worth reaching out.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I mean, just the few things that I have sold have just been such a pain. I mean, like much more than I think it's going to be.
For instance, in the photos I see, like this is for the Apple III license plate, but I see just a regular Apple license plate in there as well.
Right. And there's a little pile of license plates. I'm not sure if they're all, maybe the Apple III is one of them, but yeah, there's one of the like little black and white monitors that frequently goes with Apple IIs down there, and
so a bunch of stuff.
Definitely, interesting things.
That's how you could sell your stuff eventually, Paul. Just take a photo of your office and go here. Just you know, please tell me what you want. People will send you photos with stuff circled.
That would actually be so much easier. anyway, whatever. Okay. It's interesting. Take a look at it, you know, see if you see something you want, and conceivably you might want to contact the seller before it goes up on eBay. Actually, that's probably against eBay rules, but
yeah.
How are they going to know?
Break the rules.
I guess here's how they're going to know. The only way you know how to contact him is through the eBay listing. So buy a license plate and then get the email address. That's how you do it.
That's probably it.
All right. So the next thing, I am not too tuned into the TDI 99 4A world, but I don't think I'd come across this before. This is a CC9900 micro expansion system, which is a little box that sits on the in the sidecar position, and it is sort of specifically for RS-232 out and disk connection. So it's like a small version of the stuff you can do with the big peripheral expansion box that you get with these things. And it's in the box. It has, you know, the manual and the warranty card and everything, you know, so it's as if you had gotten it new. It looks like it's been tested to at least do the RS-232 serial stuff. So I think it's capable of doing disk connections, but it wasn't shown.
My favorite thing about the TI is when people have a massive number of expansion things off to the side. Yeah. Here's my 8-foot-wide computer. That's like the best. It's my favorite thing about that form factor.
Yep.
All right. And then I think I have the... Oh, yeah. The last thing is just... We talked a bit last time about... I forget. I think it was based on a feedback comment we got or whatever. But 3-inch disks that were used by some Sinclair computers and the Amstrad PCW and things. And so there's an auction where the seller has, 10 3-inch discs of sort of miscellaneous things.
Okay, and what's weird about 3-inch discs, I guess I've never seen them before, is they're only 3 inches in one direction.
Yeah.
Like, they're not squares.
Well, and that's actually what led me to put this in here. It's like, you know, I don't really understand what a rectangular disc is. Because... it's presumably still a circle in there, right?
Right.
It's turning.
So why did they make it longer than it needs to be? That's weird. That's very weird.
That's weird. Yeah, I haven't really, I guess I've not seen them either. I knew they existed, but I haven't really seen them. And now that I look, it's like, yep, not square.
For apparently no reason. Because, yeah, inside there's a circle turning, and then there's a bit of extra space at the label end. Must be in there just being empty. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Maybe for a handle.
Maybe there's something cool in there.
Some little secret prize.
I dig it.
Anyway, yeah. So I'm not necessarily recommending getting these, although I think they are kind of rare as media things. But these are located in the UK, so which makes sense. So are most of the Amstrads. All right, that's the end of my eBay list, and I guess we can move on to the closing discussions portion. So, Carrington, any closing thoughts? I got nothing.
just everything's me doing me all the same. No exciting retro products or projects, unfortunately. Boo.
Oh, maybe next time.
Could be. Stay tuned.
Is it? It was just Groundhog Day. It isn't Groundhog Day now. It used to be.
Yes, it is again.
Yeah.
That's how Groundhog Day works. Ken just posted a thing on Twitter that there's a PSVR. I don't know, the PlayStation VR games about to come out. That's a Groundhog Day sequel. Like you play the kid of the guy in Groundhog Day, and it's a VR. So that's weird. So that's a Groundhog Day thing.
All right.
My alarm that wakes me up every day is a sample from the movie, the Groundhog Day alarm. I use that as my alarm. I've used it for years. So it makes me laugh every morning when I wake up. It's that same thing. It's cold or something. It's cold every day. Like, it just, that has never got old.
That's a very good idea.
I'm a simple man with simple things, and every morning I wake with a chuckle.
I watched a movie just last night based on, we were talking at work about Groundhog Day, and someone said, oh, you should watch this Swedish movie that is similar in theme. The movie's called Naken, which means naked. And it's about a guy who wakes up after his bachelor party naked in an elevator and has to, like, get to his wedding on time, and like everything goes wrong, and every time he falls asleep he wakes up again back in that elevator in the morning again. So like similar to Groundhog Day in a way, but different. Like it doesn't happen on Groundhog Day, but
similar. I just saw an ad for that movie, but as a coming soon Hollywood movie, so I guess it's getting remade.
Interesting, because there's a Hollywood remake of this already that I saw a few years ago. And like,
oh, so maybe I just saw an ad for an old movie, but it's bizarre. I just encountered that trailer.
You maybe did, because and it's it like all the particulars are different, but that movie is the same. It's a guy who has to get to his wedding, and he's screwed because he's naked in an elevator. And in both of them, I think it's also it's kind of the best man who set things up because he was interested in the bride, something like that. So it's like. So someone made this movie in Sweden about 20 years ago, and then somebody must have bought the rights to it.
You could just keep releasing the movie. That works thematically. You make the one movie and just keep putting it out.
Yeah, just keep new same movie, different day.
Been continuously playing on a loop since 1985.
So apart from that movie, any other interesting thoughts from your life?
No, not so much. I think I really am going to try and hit this basic 10-liner programming contest, though. See if I can do anything interesting. Mm-hmm. Could be fun.
Yeah, it appeals to me, too. I'm gonna noodle it.
And we've got about 2 months to get anything done, so.
Yeah, but if I don't get on it right away, I simply won't do it. Like, I say that to myself, and that's how I don't do a thing.
Yeah, so tell yourself the deadline is tomorrow.
Perfect. Yeah. Yeah, no, that sounds... I may try it. I don't know. I'll look at it. We'll see.
Right.
Actually, a lot of what I've been trying to do, I've done a bit of kind of like making things in my office more orthogonal, so that it sort of seems neater. And I'm hoping to. Basically, what I'm really trying to do is figure out where everything is, because so many times in the past, you know, year or whatever, I've decided, all right, there's just junk everywhere. I'm going to put it all in a box, and I will look through this box later. And so I have. Mm-hmm. Many boxes of random things that are, or like, you know, well, random in, and also random in relation to the other things in that box. So if I want to find a particular, you know, piece of software to scan or something, it's very, very challenging. So that's kind of the main thing I would like to do with any extra time I find.
A friend of mine sorted a lot of her stuff like that into boxes, and the trick she used that failed miserably, so I'll give you a heads up in case you try to do this, is she would put the things in the box and then take a picture looking down into the box, and then she stuck that picture on the front of the box so that when she was in her she put them all in a big closet so she could look at the box and she could see what's in it. But the problem is things are layered and you can't really see, and it's a little photo, so it sounded like a good idea and it worked miserably. So that's an idea that I don't suggest.
It's possible it could be tuned. A lot of the boxes I have are sort of transparent or you know, lightly translucent, so you can kind of tell, you can kind of see what's in there, which is a big help. But still, you can only see the front layer. The front layer of what's in the box, and then the front box in the you know, several deep of
you need
boxes.
Skinnier boxes.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I'm. Looking forward to knowing where everything is so that I can finally get through scanning, and then I can get rid of it. I don't need it once it's scanned. But I said, so actually, and if anyone wants to go through and listen to all the old episodes that I've been on, probably I've been saying pretty much this ever since I started. But anyway.
Groundhog Day.
All right, well, I guess that is it for this show then. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com at a page given in the show notes. Please write a review on iTunes or wherever you find us. That will help other people find the show.
Does it?
And until next time,
Retro-compute.
Not sure how to respond to. Does it?
I'm just increasingly dubious about that. Like, someone says that, and it's nice to get a nice review. So I think if people are already found the show and they're thinking, should I subscribe or not? Some nice reviews are good. Like, it's a positive feedback thing. I think it's lovely when people take the time to give a review. That's awesome. Thumbs up. It's amazing. And I appreciate the heck out of it. But all of us podcasters always say it helps people find the show. I don't think it does. I think somebody just started saying that. So we're all saying that.
It could be. It's
dead, right.
Very well could be. Because I have
no evidence that it does anything at all.
It's true. Well, it's not like I don't find my podcasts in any way bearing on the iTunes reviews. I mean, like,
no.
I don't...
No.
Somebody recommends a podcast or whatever, and I go seek it out specifically, and I subscribe, or sometimes I search for a podcast about a certain topic or whatever. So in that case, maybe the better review, but I don't think the better reviewed ones are shown first or something. I think it's simply they show them based on how many people subscribe or something. I don't know. I don't think it helps at all. Other than it, you know, helps the ego. It's also a nice feedback thing. Like it's a positive and nice thing for people to do, but I don't think it helps people find the show. I think we're wrong about that.